right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
We've got quite a ride for you, so hang on today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Charles Bowden. Charles is the author of Murder Cities, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Now, this is a rebroadcast of an interview I did a while back, but I thought it was very appropriate given all the things that are going on in Mexico these days. Before that, we will be talking with a representative of Raja, Iranian Feminist Collective, speaking about an open letter to the anti-war movement that they are one of a few signatories to, and what's the importance of that? What's the importance of the issues that they raise about standards in the anti-war movement? But opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to have back on the show, and it's been a long time since I've had him on the show before, and I guess we'll have to correct that on a more regular basis, Joshua Frank. Joshua is the managing editor of Counterpunch.org. He's an author and co-editor, along with Jeffrey St. Clair, of the book Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back.
Sure. Hey, you sound a little bit different. Yeah.
That long ago?
No. Yeah, your voice was just changing when you were last on. Anyway, you co-edited a remarkable book, and I think it's actually, just to give people a sense of this, Noam Chomsky said, "Those who feel that like lemmings, they are being led over a cliff would be well advised not to read this book. They may discover that they are right." And it was such a refreshing book in terms of, you know, really in this season, this time where every 4 years people seem to go absolutely insane, and they go through the whole Charlie Brown and Lucy and kicking the football, and Lucy's always going to pick it up, and everybody runs and tries to kick it, and then they come back, and oh, I don't know why, we'll try again next time. There's just this total suspension of disbelief. It's an amazing phenomenon comes on, and it's also a very dangerous phenomenon. And I wanted to talk to you about your book, particularly the title, The Politics of Illusion. What do you mean by that?
Well, The Politics of Illusion, really, and it's what you were just mentioned, we're living in an era of disbelief in that we often, every election cycle, and I think this one's a little bit different than the one 4 years ago, you'll notice the majority of people right now on the progressive left end of this political spectrum aren't so excited about Barack Obama, but they are much more amped up to defeat Mitt Romney. And what this sets up is a false dichotomy that there is a valid difference between the two candidates. And what we try to lay out in the book is really a critique from the left of the first 4 years of the Obama administration, and really lay out what it is we're up against and what it really means to get behind a candidate that doesn't represent the issues we believe in, and how dangerous that is, and the illusion of change when it comes to supporting a candidate that does not represent the things we represent or the things in the direction we would like to push our politics in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, one of the things you marshal dozens of people who are writing about this and writing in a for the most part very, very deep, very challenging in terms of what they're presenting, and especially in terms of, I think, this point about, you know, what you were talking about, what we started us off with, of disbelief. You know, there is an element of sort of willfully blinding themselves, where people have willfully blinded themselves, even in relation to this. I think it's true what you're saying, that it's not the same as it was 4 years ago, where hope and change and everybody saw, you know, the first time you're going to have a black president, and there was all this going on, and there was this idea that somehow this guy who could, you know, who appeared out of nowhere, a man of the people, and, you know, I mean, I heard, you know, frankly, supposedly radical broadcasters weeping, you know, about what a difference it's going to make to have. And literally, someone once said this on this station, said, what a difference it'll make to have a black family in the White House, you know, and you keep thinking, well, what are people thinking, you know? And today you have now, it's not the same in a way. It's even worse because you have almost a willful blinding, people blinding themselves willfully to what's going on. And actually in getting behind Obama again, have a certain amount of complicity they have to speak to in relation to what he's doing. I mean, to vote for him or to push him as the alternative, the best alternative, seems to me to be legitimizing everything that he's done so far.
Right. And I mean, that's the danger of supporting a candidate that doesn't represent the things you believe in. And I think that a lot of progressives and a lot of people on the left definitely understand the pitfalls of the Democratic Party, of Obama. But what I would say is they're not willing to challenge Obama as much as they would a Republican president. I mean, you can look at the escalation of troops in Afghanistan, the drone attacks throughout the Middle East. If these policies were being brought forth by a Republican, I guarantee you that the progressives and other of those of us that are social justice activists and other things would be on the streets in protest. But since a Democrat is in the White House, mum's the word. And it's really, I think, put us in a horrible situation that these extreme policies that both parties represent are less challenged under a Democratic presidency. So I think our book is really trying to hopefully wake people up a little bit to kick them into gear, that no matter who's in power, they must be challenged.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Frank, managing editor of Counterpunch.org, and co-editor along with Jeffrey St. Clair of Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Joshua, you know, one of the things, let's get into this a little bit more because, you know, well, you yourself have paid a lot of attention to this. What do you think are some of the most telling, some of the most revealing things that you came upon in terms of, you know, as you say at one point in an essay in the book, you talk about the not only the reality, the system beginning to quickly reveal its or assert itself and reveal the truth, but also Obama's first term has revealed the utter vacuity of our political system. What are some of the key things that you see?
Well, there's a few, and I think the first one out of the gate, and it's that we're keeping a close eye on Obama and didn't have that election hangover right away 4 years ago, that they saw Obama jet off to Wall Street to bail out the bankers in the financial industry and carry out what Bush had already set in motion for the bailout. That was, I think, sign number one, as well as his economic team and putting that together, that we weren't really going to see a departure from the same economic structure and capitalist saving graces in Washington. I think that was the number one thing. And then number two, we saw Obama carrying out his promise to escalate the war in Afghanistan and carry on the war on terror. He never challenged the war on terror, the notion of it. The only thing he really ever said he would do was manage it better. Now, that's obviously very debatable. You're managing a corrupt ship, and it's cost a lot of lives, and it's definitely cost us even a greater reputation loss in countries throughout the world. So those are the two things that I think out of the gate people should recognize. And then you can get down into more specific details, such as his support for the southern section of the Keystone Pipeline. He has capitulated on a number of occasions to the financial sector since taking office. We can talk about the health care bill. There's a number of issues that I think progressives should be very cognizant of and aware of, and Hopeless really lays out every one of these issues in a timeline so that we can look back and say, hey, this is where we missed the ball. And instead of getting in front of Obama, we've always been sort of dragging our feet behind him. And I think that's to the detriment of a number of social movements in this country.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned about health care, because there's a couple other things I wanted to get into, but there's one of the things you mentioned about health care I find to be particularly repulsive and reprehensible. I mean, in terms of people want, yes, they want decent health care. But the fact is, I mean, it's not only absurd because it's, you know, if you look at it, it's actually very similar to the same thing that Romney put into practice in Massachusetts. And it's also in both cases, both Romney's and Obama's plan, they were authored by the Heritage Foundation, which gives you a hint of what the hell, what is the content of this? And then the other thing that even more importantly, I think to me is, and I would ask you about this because there's a certain amount of immorality attached to, you know, knowing everything that Obama has done, just leaving aside even just the domestic stuff, the point you were raising about the war, the torture, the drone attacks, the extrajudicial killing, the kill lists, all of these things that, you know, people are willing to accept because we'll get better health care. There's something fundamentally immoral about that.
Well, and let's be clear that this doesn't mean we're getting better health care. we're actually being forced into a privatized healthcare system. Someone like myself that's independently employed that buys my own health insurance. If I don't buy private health insurance a couple years from now, I will be forced to pay a tax. Of course, the Democrats don't want to call it a tax. They want to call it a penalty fee. But this is a boondoggle for the healthcare industry, and there's a reason why they are excited about it. There was no public option put in place, which would have been mediocre at best anyway, but at least it would have been a little balance for the healthcare system so that the premiums could not be raised astronomically and other issues. So I think what we'll see here in the coming years is a healthcare industry that becomes more monetized, more privatized, and even more expensive for the U.S. taxpayer.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the other thing, though, is, and believe me, you're talking to somebody who just realized last night when one of my teeth broke, and I realized my dental plan involves the guy down the street with a string and a doorknob. You know, I'm going to have a very rough time this afternoon, okay? But, you know, one of the things I still think, though, and this is, you know, because I'm thinking about the young guy that just died in Guantanamo that everybody knew was innocent, but the Obama administration blocked his release, all the stuff on torture, all of these things, all the things that this country is doing to people around the world. And for people to say we should get behind this guy who has not only managed it better, but taken the whole Bush fascistic program to a higher level. And is raping the world, savaging the world. And we're supposed to say, okay, well, in exchange, we get health care, perhaps, whatever it is, and we'll just turn a blind eye to what's going on in the world. That, there's something real, people really got to get out of that mindset.
Well, and especially those in the progressive left that are by nature, I think, critical of the establishment. It's a very dangerous precedent to set to future generations to allow these sorts of things to happen without a challenge. There has been really no challenge from the progressive left to any of Obama's more egregious policies. You can imagine what would happen if it were Bush in office carrying out a lot of these things, whether it's the extension of the Patriot Act, the refusal to close Guantanamo, or drone strikes, illegal drone strikes in Pakistan and elsewhere. The anti-war movement would be reinvigorated. We would have people in the streets. We would have a presence in Washington. But Obama isn't going to hear us if we don't yell. And there's something, I think, to be said to the fact that maybe Obama would be more apt to listen to us. But if we're not on the White House lawn with our signs, he's not going to hear us at all, because he can take us for granted, because he knows that every 4 years, or in this case right now, he has the progressives in his back pocket, that they, in his mind, they have nowhere else to go. And they're proving him right, and it's a systematic problem that we've seen dating back to, you know, the 70s, really. And I think that in the future, we need to start building these progressive movements outside of the two-party political system right now in order to challenge the duopoly in Washington.
We're talking with Joshua Frank. He's one of the editors of Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion, Hopeless. You know, Joshua, I mean, there's a lot. We could have a whole other discussion around where to go with, you know, this point about whether Obama actually will hear people or, you know, frankly, I think we need to get out of the whole system, the whole social structure we have. I think, you know, actually this needs to have some revolutionary change here. But one of the things I think we need to talk about too, and you have included in your book, and also it's in a recent issue of Counterpunch, is an article by Bill Quigley, who has an essay in your book. And he talks about something I think is important when people keep saying this stuff about maybe Obama would hear us, maybe, you know, he would do something, you know, he's going to do something, we can get him to do something different than Romney, who won't hear us at all. And the fact is that really we need to challenge people about what exactly do you think Obama would do that Romney would do that Obama wouldn't do. You know, think about that, because when you go down to it, you know, Bill Quigley's article of neither candidate, you familiar with that one?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it really sets things on a whole other basis. It's like, look, both of them, and this is the beauty of the kind of voting trap they have us set into, the mindset that we go out there every 4 years and people go out and vote and think they're going to be able to change things. They have us believing that, but really, you know, that's not how things change. And they made the decisions about what they're going to do way before all that. And I think Quigley's thing and even your thing around the stuff that you've written around nukes. And one of the things, one of the facts that blew my mind was that Obama has presided over the greatest proliferation of nuclear weapons in recent history.
Right. And, you know, and these are things that are obviously under the radar because the mainstream press isn't going to write about them. We're definitely not going to hear these issues raised during the debates next week. It's a problem that goes far beyond the discourse of politics in this country. It's the monopolization of our media, and that's why independent media is so important, obviously. But to get back to your point, you're absolutely correct. And I think that what people easily lose sight of the bigger goals when election season comes around because fear is the issue that takes hold. And what I mean by that is it's easy to get concerned about abortion rights. It's easy to get caught up in social justice issues that affect people's daily lives. And there definitely are, at least verbally, differences between the two candidates when it comes to some social issues. But in the bigger scheme of things, whether it's economic policy, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's environmental policy, there's really no difference. And that's where I think people get caught in the trap of this lesser evilism because they're not willing to look outside the box and frankly outside of the voting booth.
Yeah, that's an extremely important point. And I think that's something that we really have to work on because otherwise, like I said in the beginning, it's sort of like there's a certain amount of legitimizing all this every time. I think that's, to me, that's really one of the main things about the whole idea of voting is that you're putting a stamp on this is how things change and you're legitimizing it. You know, if you vote for the incumbent, you're legitimizing everything that's been done under that particular president for the last 4 years or whatever. You know, I wanted to ask you, we have time for another question, one more question, I think. And I wanted to ask you this. You raised this point about what would things have looked like if Bush had been doing all this? And it's a question of, you know, now it's a question of Obama doing all this. And I think there really is sort of similar to only Nixon could have gone to China in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Only Obama could have done what he's done over the last 4 years. It seems to me it has something to do with sort of the system sort of playing a Trump card, you know, where they've laid it out. And this is sort of like going to help them like sort of speedball their way into a whole other setup in the world. What do you think about this idea of only Obama could have done what he's done in the last 4 years?
Well, I think that you're actually correct. And I would say that the reason for that is because the people and those of us in the anti-war movement and the environmental movement that were fighting tooth and nail the first 8 years prior to Obama during the Bush administration were ready for a little bit of a vacation. they were excited about the possibility of what they thought was hope and change, and ushering Obama into office without being critical and holding his feet to the fire on a number of issues allowed him to get away with a lot of things that Bush frankly would not have been allowed to do. We've seen this play out for the first 4 years. And I think we're setting ourselves up to see this play out for another 4 years as well, because there's frankly no resistance to these most egregious policies of the Obama administration. So, back to your point, I believe that that's the only president that could have pulled off what Obama's pulled off would be a Democrat. And Obama happens to be that Democrat right now.
All right, Joshua, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll have you back before your hair turns gray, okay?
Good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joshua. Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye now. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and I've been just talking with Joshua Frank, who is one of the he's the managing editor of Counterpunch.org, and he's one of the co-editors of Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with a member of Raha, the Iranian Feminist Collective, about an open letter to the anti-war movement that they were one of the signatories to. So stay tuned. Welcome back. It's Teddy Edwards with Nothing But the Truth, and that's what we need. We need nothing but the truth. We need nothing but the truth and a plan based on the truth, and we can start to get out of this mess. All right, so let's get this. And we need the leadership to get through all that. So that's sort of the opening up to this next section of the program. I'm really happy to welcome Raha, who's a member of the Raha Collective. And it's a collective of Iranian feminists, and they were one of the signatories to an open letter to the anti-war movement in this country that has really caused quite a bit of stir, although not enough of one yet. And it's a letter that I think poses some very, very important questions and issues, and I was really eager to talk to these folks about this. So, Raha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Having fun.
I'd like to ask you to open up right away, because we're going to rush through this. I want to get as much as I can possibly get in when talking to you, and because it's so important. Tell people what this open letter is and what prompted you folks to write this.
Okay. So first of all, I just want to explain who we are. We're a New York City-based collective that formed during the rise of the Green Movement in Iran following the contested elections of 2009. And we wrote this letter in response to a series of attacks our members were experiencing by a group that calls themselves the American-Iranian Friendship Committee, which has had a long sort of standing support from a segment of so-called anti-imperialist left. So the most recent attack was a fact sheet, and this is really why we wrote the letter. It was a fact sheet released by the group's leader that claimed that members of our groups were harboring covert imperialist, Zionist, and pro-war agendas, when we have always articulated a very strong anti-war and anti-sanctions position.
Why did they say that?
To be honest, I don't know why they said that. I do know that they have a different political view than we do as far as specifically around state repression in Iran. So we're all a part of the anti-war movement, and we're all a part of the anti-sanctions movement. Now, what Raha and other Iranian and Iranian-American organizations and some of our allies that they also accused in this fact sheet, quote-unquote, what we are that they are not is we are against the state repression that's happening right now in Iran. So we are in support of the grassroots movement for democracy and for freedom in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, just to be before we get into that part, one of the things just to make clear to people, when you folks are being targeted and being labeled as Zionist agents and agents of imperialism and all this other stuff, this actually is more than just sort of the shameful lack of standards in the anti-war movement. It's actually also poses a very dangerous situation for the people involved with your groups as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. So they're not just accusations. They carry some serious repercussions. Should we, and especially the people who were named in this fact sheet, travel back to Iran? This comes from this organization. The thing about this organization is that they are people who they're invited to the dinners that the Iranian president Ahmadinejad holds or organizes when he does come to the United States. So they're just some very serious accusations.
Mm-hmm. And part of the thing is that when you talk about this, what I've read in your letter is, and I want to make this clear to people, what I read in your letter is you take a very strong stand against this, brewing the war threats against Iran. You take a very strong stand against sanctions. And actually, in one of your position papers, you do a very good job of actually laying out how, in fact, pretty much sanctions are, sort of a preparing the way or paving the way for actual war, that there's a relationship between sanctions that wage war against the people in Iran. There's a relationship between that and an actual war being launched against Iran in terms of the conditions of the people and who's being attacked. And you're making a point that you stand against both any of these imperialists, against Israel and what the U.S. is trying to do, and you stand against a fascistic regime that has for the last, since 1980, mid-1979, has meant nothing but tremendous suffering for most progressive people in Iran.
Yeah, there's been a lot of unrest in Iran for the last you know, 30 some odd years. And this regime has been squelching grassroots movements, imprisoning, you know, there's tons of political prisoners. You know, so exactly. We oppose it. So, I mean, I think if I can just broaden the conversation a little bit more, I know you're asking specifically about that, but there's this idea here that sort of if you are a part of this left movement, then, you know, the enemy of your enemy is sort of your friend. And what we're saying is that, you know, that it doesn't necessarily equate. That's not necessarily true. So the reason that people are saying that is because while, especially under Ahmadinejad, who's the current president of Iran, while he is repressing all of these the political movements that are happening right now in Iran, while he's repressing that, he also has a very strong anti-imperialist rhetoric. Right. So on one hand, he is saying, you know, the United States is an imperialist power, and that's not working. But at the same time, he's turning around in his own country and systematically really disempowering any opposition movement to his leadership and to the regime.
You know, in particular, I can't help but, you know, I just had a long conversation with someone I met a while back who is an Iranian woman who had done time in prison in the 1980s, and as well as with a man who had been in prison for 10 years from 1983 to 1993, which happened to coincide with major, massacres inside the prison by the Iranian regime. And I keep thinking about the conditions that women in particular face in Iran, and to basically not call that out would really be not only being an apologist for the regime, but except being complicit with legitimizing the kind of broad-based repression and oppression that continues to go on, which, you know, and I think, you know, what you're saying is really true, that people, you know, there's this idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, and that has racked the movement in the world for a long time, where you ended up, people found themselves being partners with the most bizarre, you know, petty dictators, you know, apologists for all this terror, you know, horrible stuff that's going on with people in the world. All this horrible, all this oppressive regimes, these butchers, suddenly, because they're opposed to the U.S., we're supposed to accept them.
Right. Strange bedfellows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing that I want to just stress is that we really believe that genuine liberation comes from below. It comes from a people's movement rather than from state leaders. And I mean, that's really evident if you listen to the people of Iran. They really are interested in changing the situation there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that you speak to in the letter, and let me remind people that we're talking with a representative of Raha, Iranian Women's Collective, Iranian Feminist Collective, and we're talking to Raha, in fact, and we're talking about the open letter to the anti-war movement that they were one of the signatories to. Now, Raha, one of the questions that I had is that, you know, there's a particularity right now that I think where this gets very, very sharp, much sharpened up. And that is that there's the threat. I saw Netanyahu this morning was just saying, there was in the paper this morning about, well, you know, we now have the red line. We're drawing the red line around Iran. And there's all of this beating of war drums against Iran. The U.S. is, you know, certainly not saying, no, we're not going to do that. They're raising their own threats. There's all this stuff that's going on. And I think one of the things that people would ask is, how do you respond to people who argue that now, in particular, is not the time to be raising criticisms of the regime while the U.S. and Israel are doing all this?
Right. I think that's a really great question. Thank you. In today's political climate, okay, so first of all, we would say that now is not the time seems like it's a very Americentric question. In today's global political climate, our stance is that if the left is building an anti-war movement, an anti-sanctions movement, because of the effects it would have on the people of a country, and I'm just going to say a country, we can't then ignore the movements, the grassroots movements that are happening within that country that are being repressed by their government. So we need to stand in solidarity with them. And actually, I would counter that idea of now's not the time with the question, well, then, what's the point? What is the point of building an anti-sanctions, anti-war movement if it's not to support the people?
Absolutely. Very good point. And that raises the question that you're also, you seem to, your group seems to be basing itself on a lot in its, in what it's saying about this in terms of its understanding of what internationalism is.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. There was just one more thing that I, sure. I wanted to say about the whole, our open letter is that our goal, you know, our goal is really to create an anti-war movement that would be free from threats and from bullying and from intimidation. So basically an anti-war movement that is true to its purported values and doesn't tolerate violence within the movement or sexism, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, we welcome debate within the movement. However, those tactics that the American-Iranian Friendship Committee has taken were not one that fostered discussion or debate. It was just to silence us.
Yeah, and that is extremely important. That was actually what I wanted to wrap this thing up on, and we can talk a little bit more about it. This idea of the need for there actually to be high standards practiced in the movement. You know, because if you're going to be out there doing that, it's exactly the point about truth cannot come and will not come from simply a majority opinion, nor will it come from, you know, bullying people into accepting it. It comes from actually, you know, it actually is real. And for people to discover the truth, there needs to be this kind of clashing of different ideas, you know, ideological and clashing and theoretical clashing and sort of debating things out. And that seemed to be something that's very much related to, again, this thing that seems to come up a lot these days, the Niemöller quote. You know, where he's talking about first they came for the communists, and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a communist. And this idea of being able to slice off very important elements of any movement of resistance to war and repression, being able to slice them off and try to isolate them using these kinds of standards, it's just got to be unacceptable.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I invite everyone, you know, all your listeners on the show and everyone to actually go to our website, rahacollective.org. rahacollective.org and read through some of our articles. And we actually have a very strong stance that counters almost everything that this fact sheet or that some, that he, basically that he's saying and some other people that support him are saying about us.
Mm-hmm. All right, Raha, we're going to wrap this up, but I want to thank you again for coming on the show today. And really, you know, people need to support what your open letter is saying and arguing for. And there needs to be this kind of movement. And particularly now, this needs to be out there. People need to be debating this open letter. They need to be standing with the people who want to stand against both the repression and oppression coming from the U.S. imperialists, as well as the repression and oppression coming from the fascistic regime, the fundamentalist regime in Iran. And Raha, thank you again very much for bringing this to the attention of the world, basically. All right.
Thank you very much for having us on our show, and thanks to everybody who has supported us in this open letter.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We have been talking with Raha, a member of the Raha Iranian Feminist Collective, and we've been talking about an open letter to the anti-war movement. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to an interview I did with Charles Bowden, the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That is Los Tigres del Norte, and the song is Las Mujeres de Juarez. It's from their album Pacto Sangre. Pacto de Sangre. It's an amazing album, amazing song, and joining us to talk about Juarez is Charles Bowden. Talk about his book, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's from Nation Books. Charles Bowden is a prolific author, and he's written quite a bit on exactly this question. A lot of the inhuman and in just the terrible things that are going on against humanity in Mexico and especially around Juarez. And this book is, I have to tell you, just to begin this, I read this book over the last couple of weeks and I was stunned. And Charles, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, one of the things I'll say straight off is you have such a tremendous writing style in terms of the, you know, you don't approach this. You're a journalist, but you write in a very poetic manner. And the power of that, that really got to me, was that it really, it has the effect of drawing you into exactly what you've been living through in terms of the horror that you've been in the midst of and trying to make sense of. You know, and you could feel the weight on that weighs on, that bears down on you, but also bears down on the people in Mexico and in Juarez in particular. You know, and as I was reading it, the Mexican government came out with a report about more than 22,000 people have been killed in the last 3 years during their so-called war on drugs. And you make the point in your book that 28% of the people killed are in Juarez, and that in many ways Juarez is not just the front line of a war, so-called war, but the concentration of a larger war. Can you give people a sense of what it's like to be human and living in Juarez today?
Yes. You're never going to be safe. There will be no one out at night. You will live in a city where 25% of the houses have been abandoned. You will live in a city with 4 police forces, which are all dangerous and threatening. You'll be occupied by 11,000 federal police and army, who are all dangerous. You'll live in a city where 100,000 jobs have disappeared in the last year or so, where 40% of the businesses have closed. And you'll live in a city with a murder rate of about 200 per 100,000. For example, in Los Angeles, it's about 10 per 100,000. In New York, it's about 6 per 100,000. And you'll have one other thing that'll make your life a little different. You will know that if you are murdered, no one will ever be arrested or convicted, because you will know in 2009, when over 2,700 people were murdered, there were only 30 arrests for homicides, and most of those were just showboat things that led to nothing.
Go ahead.
Good enough thumbnail for you?
Yeah. I think that gives people a sense of what we're talking about here. Now, one of the things is, why did Juarez become such a concentration of all this?
An accident both of geography and of policy. Juarez is across from El Paso, and it's always been a key crossing point. During the Mexican Revolution, it was a major crossing point for guns going south to the revolutionaries, for example. So it's fated by geography to be a crossroad, just like Chicago. The other factors are the North American Free Trade Agreement of 1994 sent hundreds of factories, foreign factories, into Juarez, principally American, recruited a population of poor people from all over Mexico to work in these factories, and created a huge sprawling city of slave wages. These factories have a turnover of 100 to 200% a year because nobody can live on the wages. Then the other factor is the United States, quote, war on drugs. You take a major crossroad, you enhance a product with enormous profit, meaning illicit drugs, and they're going to flow through Juarez, because Juarez and El Paso connect with the major transportation arteries of the United States. So it's an inescapable circumstance. Then finally, you get the recent president, Felipe Calderón of Mexico, deciding to show he's the man by turning the army loose on the Mexican drug industry. And Juarez, for all the reasons I've just stated, becomes the absolute laboratory of slaughter. We now have 5,000 dead in a little less than 3 years in the city, and no one will ever know the exact tally of the dead. People disappear all the time. They're not counted. Most people get kidnapped all the time. Most of them don't come back. They're not counted. We keep finding secret cemeteries, what they call death houses. In the spring of 2008, they took 46 people out of 2 death houses, corpses. They're never counted. So we're seeing something without precedent. This city is now the most violent in the world, and there's no way to predict it ending. There's 500 to 900 street gangs there. They're all feral. We've raised 2 generations, at least, of feral kids in the street because their parents work for peanuts in these factories. 50% of the adolescents in Juarez neither are in school, nor do they have jobs. It's like a perpetual motion machine, given the conditions.
You know, one of the things that, probably the only thing that many people know about Juarez, and even there, not enough people know this, but the subject of the Los Tigres song, you know, is the glaring mass murder of, rape and mass murder of hundreds of young women from the maquiladoras. Is there a relationship between that mass murder of women and the murders that you're talking about?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because frankly, that issue is something treasured so that American academics, in their gutless way, never have to look at Juarez. Look at it, over a 13 or 15-year period, there were 400 murdered women in Juarez. The rate of murder in Juarez of females is the same as in Mexico, about 10%. Of that 400, two-thirds were instantly solved because they were killed by lovers and husbands who sat there drunkenly over the corpse. At the same time, 90 to 95% of the murders are males. Now, one of the characteristics of these murders, often touted by American academics, is that the murders of the women aren't solved. Murders in Mexico are never solved. They don't have a justice system that solves things. 93% of the people convicted in Mexican courts never see a judge and never see an arrest warrant. 93% of the people convicted in Mexican courts are convicted without physical evidence. What's going on in Juarez is a U.S., in good part, a U.S.-financed city with 400 factories that produces violence against everyone. We're killing babies over there now with machine guns, you know. But if you look, if you take a little strand and focus on it, you can ignore the real hell that's been created. A city of huge poverty, no future, no law enforcement, mass violence, and increasingly a city of despair. 30 to 60,000 people from Juarez, estimates vary, mainly affluent, have fled the city and moved to El Paso, bought houses, and sit there with their money. The middle class is basically being destroyed in Juarez and in much of Mexico. And what it's come down to, the other thing in this fabled drug war, is most of the people getting killed in Juarez and throughout Mexico, most of the 23,000 officially counted, are just poor people. They're not capos, they're not big guys. This is a slaughter, a kind of almost social cleansing going on throughout the country under the mask of somehow fighting a war against drugs.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, because I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, there's different explanations, and, you know, they come from everybody, the different explanations of this mass murder that's going on, you know, that from the, you know, and you've begun to speak to some of this, the idea that it's cartels fighting against each other, or it's a real war on drugs, and the government is just simply fighting against the cartels. And you argue forcefully against each one of these. And I'd like to, you know, have you speak to why, and why they aren't what's going on, and where's the truth? And then as part of that, the role of the army and the police and the role of the government, because I think you do
sure.
brilliant exposure around that.
Oh, sure. Look, the cartels are, quote, the cartels, these drug organizations, are always fighting each other. You know, they have shifting alliances. The bloodiest year in the history of Juarez up to that year was 2007, where they killed 307 people. The next year it went to 1,600, then 2,700, and this year is going to be a world beater. You can't explain this for two reasons as cartel violence. One, the cartels never achieved this level of violence. That's the first reason. The second reason is people in the cartels aren't dying. Now, the other premise is that the Mexican government is fighting these drug organizations heroically, incidentally doing it with $500 million a year of U.S. money. Now, since the war started, we have about 23,000 people executed in what the Mexican government says is a drug war. There have been 100 soldiers killed. I mean, this is preposterous. You seriously think that these drug organizations, with their fine weaponry and everything, are being slaughtered to the tune of 23,000 and only 100 soldiers die? They're not attacking them at all. I'll give your listeners another statistic. The Mexican government announced officially they had arrested 53,000 people connected with drug organizations. Only less than 2% of those came from the major cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, run by a man named Chapo Guzman. This is all a fiction. What the army's doing is going into areas and killing anybody they want. They're kidnapping people, they're torturing people, they're raping people, and they're certainly robbing people. They have been unleashed on the Mexican people. What has happened as a consequence of that, and there's 250,000 people in the Mexican army, I should interject here that in a six-year period, 150,000 of them deserted, primarily, according to U.S. intelligence, to join the drug business where you can kill and get better pay. But what they're doing is trying to get access to the drug industry. You cannot stop the drug industry. It is probably the largest single source of foreign currency in Mexico. It earns $30 to $50 billion a year. Nor can you repeal market economics. There is a market in the United States and other countries for these substances, and these substances will be delivered. I've seen no reports that are credible since this war, or officially called the war, started 3 years ago, of any shortfall in any place in the United States of any drug, nor any deterioration in quality, nor any increase in price. So whatever's going on, it certainly doesn't interfere with the people who ship drugs to customers here.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Charles Bowden, the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and The Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's out from Nation Books, and it's a really powerful book, and I recommend, highly recommend the book to everyone.
I'd like to hear that, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Well, I tell you, I'm telling you, Charles, I've been sitting home, and I've been so immersed in this, and like I said, the artfulness in the way you present the thing adds to the power of the exposure, because it really puts you in there and you feel it, you know, and to me that's extremely important.
One thing I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and I'll tell you why. If I say 5,000 dead people, it's a number.
Mm-hmm.
And I am no different than anyone else. It just somehow passes through my mind. This is an entire city with universities and everything being essentially slaughtered and murdered. And I wanted to make people feel that, because, look, all I know how to do is write. It's the only way I can make people pay attention. So I gave it my best shot. My next life, I'll learn how to play a guitar.
Okay, and we'll have you back, too, okay?
Yeah, it is my ghost.
There you go. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things that again, this thing of what people are subjected to, and when you look at this, there's the, you know, you mentioned the military and the role of the military in Juarez and in these murders, and then there's the police who themselves either hire assassins or hire themselves out as assassins or just carry out their own thing, and then there's these groups, which, you know, I thought was important for people to understand. Some of these assassins are trained by the FBI. Some of these groups, the Zetas, were trained as a paramilitary force by the U.S. government. I mean, this is there's some very, in addition to the big money, there's actually some very hands-on training going on here.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of amateur sicarios or assassins now, but in the book, there's a real one, a guy who was a commander of the state police in Chihuahua and in Juarez, and was trained by the U.S. FBI, and for 20 years, killed people as ordered for money. He told me he knew personally where 600 people were buried in the city secretly, But what you have to understand is until President Calderon initiated this war, all these things existed, but you didn't have 5,000 butchered people. That something has changed. And what I think has changed is that war has reached a point where it escaped the control of anyone, meaning there is no one sitting in a cartel that can pick up a phone and stop the violence. There is no one in government that can pick up a phone and stop the violence. Since the Mexican army arrived en masse in Juarez, every month the violence has gone up. But this has gotten a life of its own, and it's because of the poverty and the social disintegration. I mean, people live there without running water. They have to steal electricity. That there are many, many groups of predatory human beings robbing, stealing, and killing, and nobody knows how to put Pandora back in the box. They can't even admit Pandora's gotten out of the box, because they'd have to question U.S. trade policies, namely NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Treaty, which has destroyed the Mexican poor rurally and destroyed small industry and created slave wages. And my God, they would have to question our drug policy, where we create this essentially a gangster culture because we won't let our fellow citizens ingest things we don't approve of. You can have a Big Mac, but you can't have a joint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Juarez, among many other cities, including U.S. cities, becomes a slaughterhouse because of this.
Now, let me ask you this. You make a very chilling point in the book. And again, the poetry here was, you know, drove it home. That violence isn't a deviance, but a logical career decision in this society. That it's become part of the fabric of society in Juarez. That it's not a breakdown, but a flower springing up from a bed of rot. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's a rational choice. You know, they did a university study was done in Chihuahua, which was the state Juarez is in, and it's physically the largest state in Mexico. They found out that 40% of the young males wanted to become sicarios when they grew up. Well, this is not an idiotic decision. You can find the same thing in various American cities in certain parts of the city. They know if they become a sicario or get into the crazy life, they will die. They might make it to 20, but probably not 25. But at least for a few years, they'll have the girls, they'll have a car, they'll have a rush in their life. They don't have other options. In Juarez, there's one high school for every 500,000 people. Those high schools you have to pay to go to. It's a very rare individual that can afford to go to a university. The factories there start you at $40-odd dollars a week, and if you're a real good person, you'll wind up at $75 a week. This is in a city where every price you pay every day for everything will be roughly 90% of the same as what you'd pay in the U.S. And so going into this life that I don't approve of, killing people, robbing and stealing, is not an insane decision. It's a rational decision. And you're never going to change it till you change the ground it springs from. Yeah. Unless these people have a possibility of a life, they're going to create their own life. And the kind of life they've killed now is murder.
Mm-hmm. Isn't capitalism a wonderful thing, man? Isn't capitalism a wonderful thing?
Yeah, well, you know, let's be fair here. Now, I didn't come here as Adam Smith, but what people have to understand is El Paso, which abuts Juarez. I mean, they're physically, you can hardly tell where one stops and the other starts, is at least 80% Mexican-American. Many of the people in El Paso have direct kinship ties to people in Juarez. Now, Juarez has had, as of this morning, 676 murders this year. El Paso has had 2 murders. Hmm. Now, in El Paso, you can get a job. The police are roughly on the level. When you go home at night, the water flows from the pipes. You turn a switch, the electricity is there. I'm led to believe that if you give people some actual security in life and some kind of future, they'll choose life over death. They'll choose building a society over butchering one. But I don't find it magical, or how could this be, what's happened in Juarez. Frankly, what surprises me is it took this long to arrive, because it was built in to both the corruption of the Mexican government and the economic policies of the U.S. government.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing, Charles, is I do think the point about actually even the conditions of life that people face here, oftentimes what we don't see is we don't see that what we're handed here, what we're living on here, what we're floating in, is actually dependent upon things like what exists in Juarez all over the world. You know, to me, it's a really sharp question that people really have to get their heads around and start to look at. And
I'll pounce on that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You go into a Walmart and you look at those goods, you should look at the floor. The floor is covered with blood. Those foreign objects you get in a Walmart and many other U.S. stores are made by people that are functionally slaves in Bangladesh, China, Mexico, etc. But I don't know how to legislate this, but I don't want products sold that are made by people that get a wage they can't live on. I don't want to buy into that. I'm sitting here fully dressed, I reassure you, and I don't think there's a stitch on my damn body that wasn't made by somebody working in some hellhole. And I'd much rather buy a pair of breeches and a shirt where the people went home at night and had a decent wage. I'll pay more. Mm-hmm. But I can't even find that anymore. But
one final question, Charles, and we have about 3 minutes maybe to do this.
Sure.
You pose the question to yourself, why do you keep coming back to Juarez? And you answer that it's to get a taste of the future. And you say that Juarez is not behind at times, not some kind of whacked out backwater or no man's land, but a sharp edge slashing to the future. And in particular, You say that related to this, all of the proposed solutions to poverty, migration, and crime are erased by waves of blood in Juarez.
That's correct. Look, what I mean is simple. We're living in a world under the global economy of declining wages. The biggest manufactured object in the world now is poor people. We can't wall it off, even though we're building a wall on the southern border. But it's a world where the power of the state's also eroding. Every day in Mexico, the Mexican government has less control. It controls less of the ground. It is not simply being replaced by these mythical heads of drug cartels. It's just dribbling out on the floor with places in sort of a free fall. And to go there and to look at it is to see a kind of future that I don't think is unique to Mexico. It's just pioneering some of it. And a kind of future that will spread. Now, the reason I keep going there is simple. I thought what was happening should be recorded, and I read the mainstream U.S. press, and they were ignoring it. I'm happy to say, since three people associated with the U.S. consulate there were butchered in March, now the New York Times and other worthies have decided Juarez exists. But when I started this book, I just thought I wanted to get down something. I wanted a record for the dead. I know that sounds bizarre. I wasn't raised to turn my back when people are getting butchered and saying it's of no concern of mine. That's how the book came into being. And I would like the book to be out of date and instantly Juarez be prosperous and peaceful.
And I'd like the book to be in the hands of many millions of people. I think people need to read this book. Yeah. Charles, thank you very much for the book, for the interview, for doing what you do.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, now, I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Charles Bowden, the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Field from Nation Books. But I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Joshua Frank, the co-editor of Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion. I want to thank Raha, and I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@realfuture.com. We're going to go out now with We Gotta Get Out of This Place. And Teddy, crank this one up, because this is just so, so appropriate today. Talk to you again next week.
My little girl, you're so young and fresh, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time is due. See my daddy in bed. And you.